Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. And today we are joined by Cliff Nonnenmacher, CEO of Frenosity, a visionary franchise consulting firm transforming corporate leadership. With over 20 years as a multi-unit franchisee and franchisor executive, Cliff empowers corporate executives to build generational wealth, diversify investments, and pivot careers with confidence. His honest, forward-thinking insights have been featured in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and CBS Money Watch. I've asked Cliff to join us here today to share his story and proven strategies for starting, scaling, and revitalizing franchises on how to create thriving business legacies and unlock opportunities for lasting success. So Cliff, thank you so much for joining us, my friend. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Good to see you again. And thanks for having me on your show.
We had to interrupt ourselves to actually get the interview going because this is like our second conversation.
I know.
We get along well.
I agree.
Cliff, before we get into anything kind of current and mainstream and future, how did you even get started? What were you doing before you got into the business world? Were your parents business owners? Are you carrying the torch? Do you come from a long line of entrepreneurs?
Great question. No. My dad was an aspiring entrepreneur, so he did things outside of 9 to 5, right? They say 9 to 5 is survive. It's what you do after those hours. You made that comment about what are you doing after 8 p.m. that's so productive, right? It's usually brain dead, death scrolling on social media or watching TV. So he was always working and always doing and always thinking. And he was buying businesses and he was ahead of his time on some business opportunities he got involved in. So he was an inspiration. Of course, my mother was an inspiration in a different way. She was always about hustling, make money. You're a man, you provide, you fight like hell to win, right? You don't fail, they take the no for an answer, go. So I grew up in a culture of you work hard and if you want it, you go buy it. Nothing was handed to us as kids, my brother and I. We had to work for everything. So I started my entrepreneurial journey very young, raking golf balls out of ponds at country clubs and cleaning them up with bleach and putting them in egg cartons and selling them at the entrances. Anything that you could possibly do as a child. I painted, I removed wallpaper, I shoveled snow, I picked up dog crap, watching pets, you name it. I did it if you could do it when you're really young, right? Under the working legal age. I moved to Marco. I was 15 when I moved to Marco, Florida. And that's came up with the idea of delivering food because the island was 3 miles by 6 miles. So I started a food delivery company and started delivering food for 16 restaurants, including McDonald's. I am the first subcontractor in the world for McDonald's in terms of delivering their food to the end user consumer. We were doing so many deliveries for them that we had our own cash register just for delivery. Right. Again, Uber Eats, right? You would just say DoorDash or some type of delivery. I was doing this in 1990. My cell phone was huge. It was a giant, it had a handle on it. It was wild. And and we actually had a cell phone tower on the island. It was a very wealthy island. So we had a lot of sharp people there. Definitely, it was a very affluent island I lived on. And we actually had a cell phone tower there. And there was a guy there selling cell phones. And I bought it. I operated mainly on pagers. I know I'm dating myself. The audience members would be like, what the hell is he talking about? But,
that's memory lane. All right. You got codes with your friends because you don't know who's going to read your pager.
We just did codes. You're exactly right. We did codes in time. So 16 restaurants, McDonald's, let's say, was number 5. And they would put 5. And then the number of minutes they wanted me to be there, which was usually very quickly because fast food is fast and the food quality is literally 7 minutes. Right. So we had to get it and go. Thankfully, the aisle was 3 by 6. We did really well. We put Domino's Pizza out of business like 3 times. It was crazy. We would deliver in pizza because remember, the value proposition of delivering is gone. Yep. This is what happened to Jimmy John's. Remember their old commercial? We're speedy. We're fast. Hey, fireman, grab a bucket. There's a fire. Remember that commercial? Grab a bucket. It's like they did this whole thing where it's all about speed, efficiency, and delivery. Guess what? In comes Uber Eats. And now anyone, any brand, anyone can deliver food speedy now. So your value prop is toast. It's the delivery for Domino's is nothing now. Then they cared about the quality of the product, if you remember. New CEO comes in and it's, remember that cardboard we would deliver in 30 minutes? We're revamping the whole menu. That was a huge initiative in an era of anyone can deliver food. It's not a value proposition anymore. So that took me to water sports. I see this beautiful scene behind you. I spent a lot of time on the Gulf of what is now Gulf of America. You can't say these things with a straight face anymore. I was going to say Gulf of Mexico, but it's actually Gulf of America now.
That's right.
So I used to operate parasail boats on the Jersey Shore, as well as Marco Island, Florida. I own beach concessions and jet ski rentals and catamarans. This evolved into distributing the Fun Noodle nationally. This evolved into owning a video store, and it evolved. I'm 12 to 14 brands in. I got involved in franchising in around 2000, 2003, after being an investment banker. I bought my first franchise. It was an Australian company called Cartridge World. They reverse engineered printer consumables, secret handshake chips that go on the front of the printer cartridges, chip resetters, you name it. Scaled 36 units in New York and Connecticut, sold it, moved to Florida, and continued to buy businesses and scale, and really started creating wealth. Like, being in business was great, but that was just cash flow and saying you're an entrepreneur and I'm a business owner. But I didn't really start creating wealth until I got involved in franchising and started buying and scaling businesses and selling them and cashing in and then doing it again. Our main focus was buying failed gyms. So gyms that were failing, mainly in New York, and purchasing them at a very deep discount, turning them around and selling them. And then we did it in restoration, water, fire, mold, and biohazard. So my journey is long. I'm giving you the Cliff Notes, no pun.
No, you're
the
good.
Cliff Notes
Cliff
version.
Is getting the Cliff Notes. That's a legit claim. I'm Cliff.
And here
I'm
I am hanging out with you.
That's wild. There's so much to unpack there. What a powerful tale. What were some of the biggest challenges? Obviously, it sounded like you started as a kid and then the pearly gates opened and the clouds parted and you became an investment banker and now I'm buying and flipping businesses and it's just been nothing but money city. Is that
it's
a fair
fun.
Assessment of the story?
Way more wins than losses. I had a loss on a large commercial residential cleaning concept in Palm Beach County, Florida. Worst investment of my life, and literally just shuttered it. We were doing over $1 million. It was a horrible business. And the profit was just not worth getting out of bed, in my opinion.
Wow.
I'm not a huge fan of residential cleaning. I'm not at all. I am, however, a fan of commercial cleaning. I think commercial cleaning has way better retention rates, way easier to find staff. The customer is less discerning. You could leave a hair in the sink in an office of a lawyer's building, right? But you can't do that in a residential environment. Mm. So the expectation in residential cleaning, especially where we were cleaning, we were on Palm Beach Island. You know, right. These houses are $15 million. It was a challenging business model. It wasn't for me. And that's the thing about what we do, helping people identify what investments are right for you. Just because residential cleaning is working for thousands of people doesn't mean it's going to work for you. Just because a sales organization works for thousands of people doesn't mean it's going to work for an engineer. So you got to be really careful what businesses you get involved in and make sure that business aligns with your investment objectives, your income needs, your day-to-day involvement, your risk tolerance, and your area. Just because something works in Beverly Hills and Boca Raton doesn't mean it's going to work in some small town in Minnesota.
Yeah.
So that's what we do as a consulting firm, is we're helping people navigate this process because we have battle scars and we've done it so many times.
Yeah, that's one thing I wanted to ask. So it sounds like you got involved in investment banking at one point, and then you got into, it sounded like, buying and scaling, like you said, businesses. I'm curious, what were some of the main maybe paradigm shifts that you had where prior you'd been mostly an entrepreneur and after you were more of an investor? What were some of the mental models maybe that changed for you?
That's interesting, right? So worst advice ever is, if you want something done right, do it yourself. That advice will keep you poor in perpetuity. I guarantee you that. So anyone that says, if you want something done, you got to do it yourself, they just received really bad and suppressing advice. You really need to groom other people. You really need to put management KPIs in place. You really need to leverage technology. Tech stack is all the rage right now. Leveraging technology to know, really, at every minute of every day, you really should know what your KPIs are in your business, right? What are your labor costs? What's your cost of rent? What are your cost of goods? Understanding inflation, which the average business owner really doesn't understand the impact of inflation, what it has done to their bottom line. Every expense in our life has gone up, but yet business owners continue to charge prices from 5-10 years ago. And they're out of business.
Yep.
They're out of business. And if they're not out of business, they're going out of business. They just don't know it yet.
Yep.
And that's the reality of a lot of small business owners. Those businesses are marginal at best. They cannot operate without the day-to-day involvement of an owner. And I want to make a point of saying that, because when a client's working with us, we make a point to introduce them to businesses that they can operate that do not rely on their day-to-day involvement. Day-to-day involvement is what we call a job. That's not being an entrepreneur. So we want to make sure that we're putting them in businesses that have enough cash flow and enough, let's say, that they could hire a manager, an assistant manager, and properly staff the business where they can have a life too. But more importantly, why do we do that? How are you ever going to scale and get to location number two if you're standing behind the counter of location number one?
Right. And a major threat of that is, I just spoke to a potential client in Singapore, and they had four locations, but they dropped down to three. And it was the same sort of thing where it was, I used to have a martial arts school, and I had a friend that had a martial arts school, and he expanded to a second location, and he ended up just making the same amount of money, but he just doubled his overhead. And that's what you're saying. Like, how, if you can't get out of state location number one, how are you going to scale to location number two?
It's a huge problem. Yeah. It's a huge problem. It's not just the mindset of how to do that. It's the proper capitalization to do that. Mm-hmm. It's understanding the art and science of site selection to make sure that you choose the right location to not cannibalize. Location number one's doing a million. The guy just knee-jerk reacts to a Class A space and end cap unit, anchor tenant, falls in love, and cannibalizes $400,000 from location number one.
Yeah.
What a disaster.
Right.
You ate your own flesh. Like, I mean, like, you got to really put thought into, do you know where your customers are coming from? This is where we spent decades. Go back, Daryl. All you heard was this, right? Big data. No one knew. People just parroted this phrase, big data. No one understood what the world meant when they said big data is going to be everything. Guess what? Here we are, living in a time that we know your buying habits to the right of a decimal point. They know where I'm going today, tomorrow, next. Yep. They know it goes to BMW. They know if it goes to Gucci, Louis Vuitton. Yep. They know where it lives. They know the value of the house. They know the car it drives. They know everything about us. Yep. So when big data is aggregated, now let's break that down to the small business owner. Did you get an app? Yeah, an app is not expensive to build. Yep. Stop. It's so easy to get apps now. Like, for $2,500, you get a really good app that is aggregating data. Do you know where your customers are? You know what? I bought an app. I implemented the app. I gave everyone a free something to download the app. Now I know that my customers live 6 miles radius from my store. Guess where you're going to build location number two and three? Mm-hmm. Now you have this data with Placer. I don't know if you ever heard of Placer.ai. This is brilliant technology. This technology is using cell phone tracking to determine how many automobiles are pulling into the strip mall every day, every hour, every month, every year, everything. Daryl, they know that the cell phone that pulled into your strip mall came from, let's say, another strip mall, or it came from this community, or it came from this auto dealership. They know the buying habits, the spending habits, the movement of money. These phones are basically tracking devices.
Oh, 100%.
And now it's all there to be bought. Big data.
I love that. There's a couple of things that, one, and it's amazing we still don't have any more info on Epstein. But anyways, the 50s and 60s, people talking on the phone would say, hey, let's talk about this in person. The wiretapping was a thing. They might be listening. And now people are like, excuse me, wiretap? Hi, Alexa. I'd like to know. It's just
absolutely
in their house. And it's
this mic, that mic. I got five mics right around me. Multiple headsets.
John McAfee, what was it? McAfee from Antivirus? He says this thing where people are worried about spyware. You're going to use Signal before he died. Signal, all these things. Like, it doesn't matter about the end-to-end encryption of your apps because the device you're inputting them on is watching your keystrokes. Like, it doesn't matter that you're using encrypted messaging because the device you're using is that. And that's part of why you get them so free as well, right? Because that data is valuable. I want to come back to something because I spent $50,000 in 2020 prior to AI coming out, which I still think is very valid and provides deep insights. But I spent $50,000 to hire a team of research assistants to help me go through all the academic literature on business success to figure out what really moves the needle for small and medium-sized businesses. Everybody was arguing about the science of this, the science of that. And I said, what does the science have to say about business success? And we looked at studies from all over the world and we identified 8 critical success factors: self-efficacy, market intelligence, strategic planning, marketing strategy, sales strategy and skills, money management, business operations, and business intelligence. Those were the big 8 umbrella categories that capture everything. Right. And the one that I feel people struggle, there's kind of 2, self-efficacy, a lot of people struggle with, the marketing part in terms of lead gen. But then the third one is the dashboards, the business intelligence. And you really just hammered on that for people. I want to ask, are there specific tools? How do people get an accurate dashboard? part of that is being able to step away from the business enough, but are you just basic accounting reports? Like you say, at any minute, you should be able to have an up-to-date.
Yeah. Great question. So I've been doing this as long as you could possibly do it. So I've been doing it with spreadsheets and doing manual data entries. There was always an admin, right, in my life at some company where we were aggregating all this data. I wanted to know, and I use the term to the right of a decimal point because I'm being literal. I literally want to know how many leads to a deal, how many outbound dials to a sale. I want to know everything because with that data, I can reverse engineer and say, and I love these people come in and go, I'm going to do 2 million this year. How are you going to do it? How many do you need? All they have is a blue sky, lofty goal. We used to say, I had an old boss who would say, you got to be strategically rigid and tactically flexible. All right. So you have a strategy. You want to make 2 million a year. What are your tactics to achieve that? That means you don't know. And I guarantee you, you're never hitting that number. So I know exactly how many needs I lead. I know exactly how many people you're going to need. I know exactly how many outbound dials you need, how many confidential questionnaires you need, how many of everything that you need to hit a number. And I don't think enough business people do that. And as for your financial acumen comment, what I have learned over 20 years of doing this, and it's downright frightening, that is that the financial knowledge of the average person is really just terrible.
That's on purpose. The education system doesn't teach you how to file your taxes. It doesn't teach you that. It prepares you to work in a factory, right?
And to take orders and to take instructions and to not think for yourself. Yeah. I am blown away, though, that post knowing that. So now you know that, all right? And now you're buying a small business and you don't know the difference between a P&L and a balance sheet. Let's just start with the language and the nomenclature and identifying these documents. They still really don't go out of their way to dig in and learn. And that's one area of franchising that I think every franchisor could do a better job is making sure that they understand QuickBooks, they understand just general accounting, they understand how to read a P&L, they understand how to use that balance sheet, right? Mm-hmm. And the vitals that it provides, presuming it's not garbage in, garbage out, presuming that they're putting in accurate data about their business, solid revenue numbers, solid rebates, returns, everything. Right. I just think there's so much to learn from dashboards. And again, I've been living by them. People say, oh, you're a salesman. I use a lot of data. So I'm 100%. A data geek when it comes to making business decisions.
So you're really big just on the basic financials or any layered over, because P&L doesn't necessarily tell you. I'll let you answer that question.
Yeah, I think you were just going through some things and you asked me about scaling. And I see that as an opportunity. I think that site selection has a lot to do with scaling brick and mortar. That's less important, obviously, in non-brick and mortar brands. One of my most successful investments was a non-brick and mortar brand. How do we make that successful? Is understanding the marketing and understanding how many people it's going to take and understanding then how many vans I'm going to need and how many techs I'm going to need and how much drying equipment I'm going to need and desiccant machines and hydroxyl machines and ozone machines and air movement. We were in the water, fire, mold, and biohazard business. So no matter what business you're in, it always comes down to math. It's always a math problem. Right. When you really think about it, it's always people, product, and process.
I like that. So when you work with people, what are type of the biggest mistakes that they make? You've already alluded to some, like a lot of people don't have enough financial literacy. You talked about the location that, but when you tend to come work with a client, what are the top 3-5 potholes
and pitfalls? Yeah. The folks that we could determine pretty early on if they're fit for franchising in general. Franchising is a methodology, right? Yes, it's an industry. It's more of a methodology of growing. You could grow organically like Chipotle and Starbucks, or you could grow like McDonald's or Subway and say, no, we're going to sub-franchise and sell these units to folks and they could operate them. So making sure that the person can fit inside of a system and execute that system flawlessly at the local level and represent the brand properly. And you just know when someone is not going to be fit, the way they push back, the way they ask questions, the way they communicate, usually combative, instead of seeking to understand, they just want to be understood, that type of individual. So we could determine pretty quick. And then they'll start to say things during the process like, oh man, you know what? I could do tattooing. I could do that. I could sell hot dogs. No, you're not selling hot dogs at McDonald's. Like you're not offering those services at these brands. It's follow the model. And a lot of people can't follow simple instructions and they're not a fit. They should hang their own shingle yep. and live a mediocre life.
Yep.
Versus but joining a franchise.
They always want to improve it. I've tried to do a partnership deal between two different companies. One that's been around for 55 years. The other one's been around for 20 years. And things are coming along, but prior to partnering these two, I've tried to put a lot of other deals together. And I just kept coming up to people think they can innovate on this 55-year-old businesses philosophy. And I'm like, they've been doing it for 55. Sometimes the brilliance is in what's not there. And I just yesterday got a bunch of engineering drawings back where they're showing me how they've improved it. And look how much better this is. And all I'm seeing is complexity and like, where's the simplicity? And that's, it's that whole, like you said, it's anyways, it really struck a nerve with me because I'm like, guys, I've been working with you guys we're at 18 months on this project. I've sent these drawings back 3 times and you're still trying to innovate on them.
Right.
Just stop.
And make it more complicated.
It's been
very typical.
Refined over 55 years and reduced to just the minimum, like the path of least resistance, the simplest system that performs the function. And now you've given me this, oh, look how brilliant I am as an engineer. No, I think you're an idiot. I think you're just trying to show off your ego and you want to show how good you are. And you don't know what you don't know. And I don't know what I don't know. Let's go talk to the people who've been doing it for 55 years and find out why they're doing it that way.
And the fact, what's crazy about that whole story is that the real genius is in the simplification of complex situations.
Oh, yeah.
And I never truly understood that until an iPhone came out. And at that moment, I understood exactly what he meant when he said, I'm carrying around a BlackBerry and I think this is the smartest thing ever designed. I got a trackball, QWERTY board. I got all these buttons. You got to be kidding me.
Yeah,
the most difficult thing you will ever do in your life is to simplify complicated situations. And here we are with this genius device.
Yeah.
Absolute. Brilliant, simplistic. There's 3 buttons on here. I know. I never understood it. And again, a lot of people don't have the, that's why when they're not visionaries. They don't see what these visionaries see. Brilliant.
I love that. So what are some of the most important maybe skills and behaviors that you think are critical in today's business environment?
Yeah, I'll tell you, being a change agent helps. Do you have to be? No, but it does help. Because we are being whipsawed legislatively, politically in the country, like every 4 years with a 4-year term. Sometimes it's really nice to get an 8-year term, whether you like the guy or not. At least you have consistency in regulation and legislation and all those other geopolitical events. So sometimes it's nice to have that. So I think being a change agent, and this world is moving so quickly. Products are moving so quickly. We have AI now, quantum computing. We have all these things moving fast. I think that the ability to be able to follow a model, the ability to say I have a history of success with, let's say, maybe managing people or a burning desire to want to be successful. You have some fire in your belly, some hustle, because that accounts for a lot. And hustle can make up for a lot of other things that you're missing. It really can. I've met some really wealthy people and they are not the smartest people, but they grind it out. They do. They just move. Operating capital is incredibly important. Being properly capitalized, it is one of the number one reasons why people fail in franchising and in business. They run out of runway. They run out of operating capital. They had just enough to buy the business, but not enough to get to the finish line of break even and profitability, and they bail. And it is a tragedy.
I think I want to dive into that. For people that don't really know, runway is how long you can keep things running without a new sale coming through the door. If you lost all your clients and whatnot today, if a new COVID happened, how long could you continue to exist and innovate prior to having to turn off the lights and shut the door?
That's right.
And that is such a, I think that if you have less than 6 months of runway, that's a red flag and you need to try to do something to fix that situation as soon as possible. And for a lot of people that are owner operators, you've got 2 types of runway. You've got my family, my personal life, and then you've got operating my life and the business. Those are 2 separate financial statements, but that's something that most people, they're like chunks of money come in, chunks of money come out. As long as the chunks coming in are bigger than the chunks going out, I'm good.
Going out. But
then you have to know, you have to know how much runway you have. And you also have to know how secure that is. That's something that people really dance around, but we've had some banks shutting down recently. We've had people that think they've got millions in the bank account, saying the wrong thing in public, and all of a sudden that money's inaccessible. Governments, I'm from Canada. Governments have not necessarily always been friendly. You wake up, suddenly your bank account's shut down. It's
happened.
It's crazy. It is a crazy time to be alive. It's an exciting time to be alive. That's for sure.
It,
So
definitely. Yeah. It's an under a lot of people in my world. They just want to talk about the upside of being self-employed and all the life benefits and being in control of your destiny and create wealth and all. Look, there's a downside and people need to understand that there are risks to every investment. We need to put those on the table. If you determine that, I just had a conversation just an hour ago before being with you. And it was a lovely couple in Illinois, and we were having a conversation. I said, I was getting a vibe on the intestinal fortitude. And I just go, let me ask you this question. If you two lost 150 grand on this deal, does it like really change your life? Yeah. Both of them are like, yes, don't do that. Then don't do this. Like you just don't have one. Clearly, you don't have the cash reserves, right? You didn't amass enough wealth. They were almost 60 years of age. Or they do have a lot of money, but they view losing 150 as the end of my life.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, again, you just don't have the risk proclivity to do something like this.
Yeah.
So go do something, go do an Airbnb, go do something that you would enjoy, like something that doesn't have as much risk with a landlord, with a personal guarantee, with employees, with a big investment, do something different. So we have no problem telling people you're not a fit. I'm sensing a ton of fear. I don't want to put you in a bad situation.
Yeah, I really value that. That's, I think once you've got, my buddy and I used to call it roof and ramen. Once you got roof and ramen covered, you really need to be focused, I think, on values, doing business with values and integrity. And having, we talked about this before the start of the call, the movie Groundhog Day. For me, it's what's the day I need to live every single day in my life that I can do with joy and not only like where I end up when I'm 80, but who I've become. And it's not, you can do the close calls, you can do all that stuff. But once you got roof and ramen covered, it's really just, I think, building a moat around what you got.
That's right. With preservation.
Yeah. It's just not, don't lose it. Don't lose it. Preserve it. I was foolish. The first 100 grand I had, cash and mattress. I helped retire my parents. I did a bunch of stuff with that. On easy come, easy go. I think that's critically important. There is a rush to it. And at the end of the day, we're all going to die anyhow. So you got to choose how you're going to play this game. Alan Watts has this great talk he does called The Dream of Life. And he says, let's imagine for a moment that every night you went to sleep, you could dream 100 years of life or however many years of life that you wanted to live. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, the first weeks, months, whatever, years that you discovered this skill, you would have the most luxurious and lavish lives, right? You'd be nothing but endless pleasure. But after a while, that would become boring and you want a little adventure and a little bit of risk. And slowly but surely, you do riskier things and be like, oh, that was a close call. And then one night you would say, tonight, when I go to sleep and I dream this life, I don't want to know I'm going to wake up and it's all going to be okay. And in the infinite possibility universe, you could be dreaming the life that you're dreaming today. So there is a bit of, hey, let's be like Elon and put it all on the table and let it ride for the fourth time. But depending on the person, maybe not everybody has that sort of risk tolerance. Get your roof and ramen and then start worrying about what if scenarios. And I think you're not necessarily playing it safe, just you don't want to be 60 and put it all on the table and lose and go, oh shit.
You're never going to recover. Right. They'll never recover.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that now they just mortgaged their future when you were trying to retire uncompromised. Now you just mortgaged your whole future.
Right.
I don't want to be part of that.
Yeah. 100%. So what are looking forward? Obviously, no one's got a crystal ball, but what are some of the trends that you're paying the closest attention to? Like you said, so much is changing right now, geopolitically, technologically, culturally. What are you trying to keep your eye on over the next 5-10 years that you think might be really important for all the other business people?
So we just mentioned in this era of AI, and we're having this conversation in March of 25, you have AI, quantum computing, the world is moving at like light speed. Whatever you thought last week is going to change tomorrow. So we're looking at brands that are AI proof, at least we believe for the next decade, which in business is a long time. But you think about 10 years, right? I'm looking at anything involving the use of tools. And from a squeegee, from a paintbrush, to a plumber's wrench, a pressure washer tool.
Analog tools, not software online tools.
That's right. Thank you for saying that. I'm looking at anything that requires physical feet on the street, an HVAC guy, the plumber, the electrician, the roofer, the painter, anything in those areas. I'm long, I love, and I think they're AI proof and they're obviously Amazon internet proof.
Yep.
So men, if you think about what we've done to men or what we've done to trades and why I say feminization of men, is because over the last decade, and this includes Canada, male sperm counts dropped in the last 10 years, 50%.
Yep.
Think about that.
Oh yeah.
And not with that came testosterone levels that have plummeted. So when you look at the war on men, everyone wants to protect women. And I love this comment. It's, we got to look out for women. We got to look out for women. And a lot of people are saying, do you want the best for women? They need strong
men. Yeah. 100%.
They need manly men. If you really want to take care of women, you need manly men. If you really want a strong society, you need manly men, because society's toast.
And right. Some people are wondering if birth, this is pure speculation, but they're wondering about the explosion of birth control, confusing the signals of what women find attractive.
Interesting.
Because that's now
interesting. Birth that control, I've never heard.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It confuses the signals. And all of a sudden, what does that do on a social cultural status in terms of what's being elevated as ideal and desirable? And there's also,
it's a midget, a bald midget. Like, what does that mean? Well, you're saying that if it was tall, dark, and handsome, you're saying that the pill could make them be attracted to the opposite, to exaggerate your comment.
Well, because now all of a sudden your priorities have shifted. So now instead of looking for a strong protector and provider, you're maybe looking to get along more because you're already pregnant.
Interesting.
So you're looking for softer, gentler touch, so to speak.
Interesting.
That's pure speculation, of course, but it does come back to the fact that, like, where society's gone, we're becoming really detached. We talked about this at the beginning. The founding kind of cultural values that made the West great I mentioned usury as an example, where the Catholic Christian values typically, of course, there's black market type deals and things that go on and people find workarounds, but as a general principle, usury is extremely frowned upon in those kind of philosophies. And that means if we apply that to the Western civilization, credit cards would be abhorred. We wouldn't have 30-year mortgages. And then it would be inconceivable for a politician to print money like they do now. And that's not bedrock what made us strong, so to speak. And they also say that when you look at evolution for women, typically it was the men that were warring. Okay, let's go toxic masculinity route. We have all these toxic men running around. Let's say I've got Viking pass. We row a boat for 12 weeks to arrive somewhere, kill all the men, keep the women we like, have a bunch of babies, and then move on. Some stay behind, whatever, right? Okay, super toxic masculinity. For those women that are left behind, they have to adapt and they have to learn to deal with that trauma, accept it and move on and be more agreeable to their new situation, as opposed to the men that would react like a white blood vessel, like a white, you know what I mean? Like an immune response where they would fight the invading horde. And so you talk about the feminization of men. We've lost that grumpy, cantankerous male aspect to wait for a minute. Let's think about this. Stop. Right. Because that evolutionary problem, women are just generally more agreeable than men as a personality trait. And so how much of it is just women typically look for consensus, where a high testosterone male needs to be won over. You're not going to get in a cage with a tiger or a lion and be like, hey, buddy, let's cuddle.
Right.
You're going to have to win him over. And you have to be really smart. So anyways, so to what you say, like I agree that there's, so that's great. So
we have the tools. So you have tools, anything involving tools, anything involving men's health. And I'm putting it under that one category. So tools, men's health, testosterone therapy. It could be all those things. Second category, we talked about this as well. This country is aging and it's aging rapidly and we're not repopulating. So anything involving what we refer to as the silver tsunami, right? This huge graying of America is a huge business opportunity, whether it's home care, whether it's mobility, whether it's assisted lift chairs or non-medical transportation. There are so many ways to capitalize off of the aging of America. And again, back to your legacy comment, really feel good when you turn 80. That's what have you done? Those are some really fulfilling businesses when you're caring for your aging population. Oh, yeah. Next category would be the humanization of pets and animals. Since we're not repopulating and since we're aging, we literally humanized the lion, the tiger you just referred to. So when you say, hey, you wouldn't go in there and cuddle them, today you would get that tiger very small so that you could cuddle them and you could humanize them. And we would put clothes on them and we would have birthday parties for them. The drill, you've seen it. There are spa parties.
They are full on.
$1 billion business, $160 billion in the U.S. for anything in the pet space. The humanization of pets and animals is a massive, whether you're boarding them, grooming them, training them, if it's daycare, veterinarian, I don't care what you're doing, they're $160 billion market cap. Next would be any, since we're aging, anything anti-aging, anything biohacking, peptides, NACs, testosterone therapy, beauty, vanity, sensory deprivation, red light therapy, right? All this stuff is very popular. And I'm starting to see money move from your traditional gym, call it LA Fitness, Orange Theory, right? I'm starting to see money move from there and going over to the biohacking space in a world of Atiya and Huberman Lab and Osprey and all these guys that are, look at the documentary that came out with Brian Johnson.
Yeah,
guy lowered his metabolic age, like 20 years. It's crazy.
Yeah.
He has the skin of a 10-year-old. It's nuts.
Oh yeah. You can go, I think there's an 80-20 for anyone interested in that. Here's the 80%. Good sleep. The hours you sleep before 10 PM are worth more. Regular exercise. You need cardio and weight training. Hit high intensity interval training, CrossFit, they got it right. In terms of diet, meat, vegetables, nuts, seed, fruit, eggs, coffee, tea, water. That's basically it. If it has a food label, it's not food. Brian Johnson's got his own sort of food.
I love that.
Oh yeah, it's not food. It's
like, I love simplicity. If it has a food label, it's not food, right?
There's no food label on broccoli. You don't go to the broccoli.
Flip it over. I love that.
Tomatoes.
If it has a food label, it's not food.
If it's the whole drug dealer thing, I buy a pound of cocaine, I mix it with a pound of baking soda, and I have 2 pounds of inventory. I got some real food. What opened my eyes to that in the beginning was when I lived in Japan. I lived in Japan for 3 years, and they have a law where they have to put how much actual juice is in the bottle. So when you go buy like your Tropicana and all this stuff, and I was so shocked because there was basically 3, maybe 4 amounts, 1%, 500%. And I was so shocked because there were products that I would buy in Canada where I'm getting real juice and I'm looking and it's 1.5 and I'm picking up my jaw off the floor because I'm just like, wow, that was such an eye opener for me that they had, because they had to put that on the bottle. And there's all these like juice blends and stuff. And you look at it and you're like, this is 1%. This is 5%. I thought this was 100% juice.
Right.
So Brian Johnson has everything dialed in really well, but sleep, diet, exercise. That's
for the average person that doesn't want to spend $2 million a year.
Even when you look at a supplement, so you can get a long way just looking at best practices.
Totally.
But Brian really, like, nothing but respect for him. And he has taken it to the nth degree and he makes it all public. And I love that. And of course, now he's got his product line and stuff. But I was super happy because I took a look at, I've been following what he's doing. I'm like, I'm doing close to 90% of all this. And I didn't need to drop $2 million. So we're good. We're good. I didn't mean to interrupt. Anti-aging.
It was the beauty, vanity, anti-aging, biohacking. That whole category is being backfilled by franchise concepts. And then lastly is child enrichment. I believe that the public school system has failed miserably. And I believe that they've killed programs that really help a young person become a productive member of society and be able to think for themselves and to be able to solve problems and be able to have reasoning skills. And they took it all away. And people thought art was just like, this is silly. Art has everything to do with the two hemispheres of your brain, right? Art has everything to do with looking at the world differently. Art is so powerful for strategy and strategic thinking. You look at executives and you look at these powerful people, the Jack Welch's, the Steve Jobs, like playing an instrument. Yes. Yes. And they took it all away. They took away welding. They took away wood shop. They took away home economics. Took it all away. These kids are going to college. They can't even cook. They can't crack an egg. They're just useless. It's sad.
100%.
Currency?
Yeah. What do you think was happening with currency?
Like right now, if you asked me that before Trump came in, I would have told you that the dollar is going to be worth like a penny.
Right.
I mean, it's just, obviously, it's just been doing nothing but go down. We've been devaluing and printing the U.S. dollar. So I can only speak my own country. But I do think that cryptocurrency is absolutely 100% the future. I still think that there is a weird answer to why can't I wire money after this certain time of the day?
Yeah.
Like, why can't I, how come I, Daryl, how come I can't wire you money on Saturday morning?
Yeah.
Why? It's 2025. Why can't I wire you? We just took a 20-story rocket and landed it with 2 chopsticks.
Yep.
And I can't wire you $2,000 on a Saturday morning?
Yep.
I don't understand.
Yep. And if none of it makes sense with certain countries, even if it's $500, you have to do a whole anti-fraud, anti-money laundering thing. But Zelensky doesn't know where $100 billion went that was sent to him. There's just something weird going on.
I agree. I'm trading crypto 24/7, 365.
Yeah.
Constant movement money. The market never sleeps. You're always able to move and wire and do what you got to do and trade and sell and buy. I don't really understand. They don't have an answer for it either. It sounds, look, we or the people have outlived the usefulness of our current institutions by probably 20 years.
Oh, yeah.
If you think about it. Look at New York Stock Exchange. Yep. Why? Why does that even exist? There are actually people with feet walking around down there. Why?
Yeah.
You don't need anyone. The New York Stock Exchange has outlived its usefulness by probably 30 to 40 years.
Yep.
Look at the NASDAQ.
Yep.
Come on. This stuff, this makes no sense. It's time to reshuffle the deck. It's time to hit the reset. It's time to do the power shift. And I'm a big fan of crypto. I'm a big fan of investing in alternate things like art, like real estate. I like everything, honestly. I don't think that there's an investment. I don't like NFTs. That was a weird play for me. And Gary Vee was pushing it. And it was strange with the Bored Ape and millions of dollars for this NFT. That didn't work for me. But the concept of an NFT, for example, wouldn't you like to own a Picasso? Guess what? You could own a fractional ownership in a Picasso, an Andy Warhol, a Banksy, a Basquiat. You could own them right now. Fractional ownership through Masterworks. I don't need an NFT. I actually have invested. I got about 40 pieces of artwork in these artists they're like 15 million, 3 million. You can't.
Yeah.
Who could afford that?
But you can
through fractional ownership, which again, if look into it, if you're into a non-correlated asset class, non-correlated, because this is for the Bezos and the Gates and the big guys. If you look into masterworks.io, it's fascinating.
Yeah. Okay.
That's very Masterworks. Scott Lin is the creator, founder of the concept, and he is the first person in history to securitize with the SEC a piece of artwork. And the first one I bought was Marilyn Monroe. If you remember the Marilyn Monroe, Andy Warhol, I thought that was so cool to grab a piece of an Andy Warhol, right? And then I really got into it. I'm like, okay, this is cool. And they actually take physical possession of the art. It's all in a vault, and I think it's in Maryland. And check it out. You will be very impressed with the way the platform operates and the secondary market. You'll check out the secondary market and how you have liquidity. And I actually enjoy the secondary market. It's where I buy most of the art now, is on secondary, not primary IPO.
I love that. I think that's really powerful. And I think NFTs make sense for something like maybe a membership, because it's proof of authenticity, but not a gift, not something I can screenshot. And then somebody said to me, you use Solana to gamble your money. You use Bitcoin to store your money's value. And you use Zcash to spend it, because Zcash is the whole privacy platform.
Right.
That's basically, you use Zcash to spend it, you use Bitcoin to store it, and you use Solana to gamble it. And of course, there's all sorts of other things in there. So Ethereum was something like use case invest it. Anyways, it's going to be an interesting future. That's for sure.
Oh, totally. It's happening. I can tell this administration is making it happen. I assure you. I'd imagine the Fed is going to embrace some type of crypto, like an XRP or a Solana.
They have to.
I agree.
At this point, the banks are having to endorse and get on board with crypto because of the things that you mentioned. I can go with Bitcoin anywhere in the world and do transactions, and there's no intermediary. There's no conversion fee. I don't need to compare exchange rates at these different currency exchanges, and there's none of that. It's one of the first times we've had pure money where we haven't had to worry about people taking silver coins and putting copper slugs in the middle of them, or coin clipping, or any of that sort of stuff. And now, especially with what people have done with the whole money printing, there's a lot of how much money is in circulation. I have a friend here in the Philippines. His job is to hunt down massive amounts, because the U.S. is not the only country that prints U.S. dollars, right? Other countries get minting plates, and they're put on schedules and quotas, and there's serial numbers on whether they get put on the international ledger or not. And in Marcos's time here in the Philippines, when they had martial law, he got plates and he had a schedule, and they just blew through it. They're like, whatever. And they just printed. And a buddy of mine, his job is in these generals, and he sent me videos where some of these generals have like a warehouse of pallets of Benjamins. And the guy will have $100 million, and his job is to go try and negotiate with generals. I can give you 5 million real dollars.
Right. Right.
But you got to give me this so we can ship it to wherever. With legit serial numbers. You take this to a bank, you're going to get arrested for fraud. And a lot of the generals are just holding out. They're like, forget you. I got 100 million. I'm going to keep paying 10 grand a month to warehouse it and keep it secure. But this is just all over the planet type thing. And so
that's wild.
It's just a super fascinating versus what we have with transparency with ledgers online. And that, like you say, it's an old archaic system. We've never had.
Blockchain's going to take over everything. The deed on your house, it's going to end up becoming the standard technology, the blockchain, for sure.
That's really powerful. Cliff, this has been such a great call. I feel like it's worth someone listening to more than once. I want to be respectful of your time. Is there anything I haven't asked you about that I should have asked you about?
No, just what we do. A couple of things I'd like to mention, if you don't mind, is we do have our own podcast. It's called Pursuit of Profit. Doesn't compete with you at all, being respectful. Okay. Yeah, we only interview founders of franchise brands, and we stay right in our lane with franchising only. The next thing is we have a book coming out probably in June called Beyond the Brand. And it's going to talk about everything we're doing now, which is go beyond the brand. Like, right? You were talking about the person, the personality, the mindset, the liquidity. We get into that. It's not just about, hey, what brand should I buy? We go beyond the brand. Yeah. So we're coming out with that. And our services are free. So if anyone's listening and they're like, hey, I really like what I heard, I'd like to work with that firm or work with Cliff, they can reach out to us. That's franocity.com. Schedule a consult. Everything we do is free. Nobody believes free, Daryl. But what we do is actually free to the buyer. We're compensated like realtors. So we're paid by the seller. So we work for the buyer for free. We help them identify investments. And if they purchase an investment, we're compensated by the seller. So it's 100% free, no obligation. And that's what we do. And I appreciate you having me on.
Obviously, people had a chance to sniff you out. They know you got the goods. Go check out franocity.com. Definitely talk to Cliff, if anything, just about maybe how you can invest your money, how you can get involved with more of a franchise mindset. We didn't even really talk about Gerber and that philosophy of like lead generation, lead conversion, client fulfillment, those three systems and creating processes around them. And we touched on it a little bit, talking about obviously needing dashboards, needing to be out of the day-to-day, that if you want it done right, you have to do it yourself as a philosophy that will keep you poor because you don't scale. You only have so many hours in a day and success is a team sport. And so we didn't even touch on any of that.
I completely agree with you. And and it's funny because we mention Michael Gerber, E-Myth Revisited on our show all the time. We mention it on our show so often that I have the producer going back in the transcripts to pull the number of times. And I'm going to create, Daryl, I need your help. I'm going to create a sizzle reel where all the times we mention Michael Gerber, because I would love to interview him. The guy is just so ahead of his time with that book. It's great that you had him on your show. You did a great job booking him. He's awesome.
I'm actually still running some of his systems. We talk about, message me after. Send me the sizzle reel.
All right. I would appreciate anything you do to make an intro would be great.
But he's obviously, Michael's fantastic. He's pushing 90. I think he'll be 90 pretty quick. Obviously, follow everything that Michael's done, understands philosophy, but you probably need someone like Cliff or myself to really help you execute on that stuff. If you're looking to just get into it as an investor, Cliff is definitely your best bet. I'm a fish out of water in that. That's something maybe I would aspire to. I don't have Cliff's background, so maybe I'll sign up for his free. Go check out Franocity, Franocity, and go check out, it'll be on Amazon, I'm assuming, and everywhere else, Beyond the Brand, right?
Beyond the Brand. Oh, definitely. Yeah. I would think around June.
People download all throughout the year. So I still get downloads of podcasts we did in 2016. So go look up Cliff Nonnenmacher. Did I say that right?
That's right.
Nonnenmacher. Cliff, Cliff. Last name, Nonnenmacher. The easier thing to do is, of course, just go check out .com, Franocity. Cliff, it has been such an honor and a pleasure to have you here. Like I said, I've got a page of notes. People probably want to go back, listen to this call again, make sure they got all the goods. Thank you so much for your time. Knowing you got your own
followers,
your own family. Thank you, man. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Daryl. Appreciate it.